everyone, and welcome to this first part of the ASU GSV Summit series of 10 episodes on the EdTech Podcast. This week, we'll be diving straight into a live recording from the 2017 Summit entitled Play It Smart, Games and Neuroscience, Making an Impact Finally in Education and Talent. I'm in conversation with Dr. Frieda Poli, CEO of Pymetrics, Vikas Gupta, CEO of Wonder Workshop, Michelle Becker, Executive Producer for Minecraft The Education Edition, and Luen Choi, Chief Product Officer at Pearson. We touch upon everything from efficacy and engagement and access and immersion along the way. And if you like what you hear, you can check out more games-based learning and neuroscience content from the ASU GSV Summit team, including videos, podcasts, and reading on this topic in our show notes, weekly email, or ASU GSV Summit website, asugsvsummit.com. Don't miss presentations from the CEO of Unity, blogs on what Human Genome Project has to do with teaching and learning, and videos from past EdTech podcast guest Lightner. And if you're not signed up to the EdTech podcast weekly email, do it now to make sure you get hold of all the latest news, events and insights. But first, before we kick off with this week's episode, here's Michael Moe with the GSV Partners perspective on gaming and neuroscience to set us up for this week's episode.
We see gaming and neuroscience being two mega trends that are converging together that are going to have a major impact in how people learn. And so we're very focused on companies and ideas that are looking at creating the greatest aspects of gaming, which is engagement and how people really spend time on a task with the continued knowledge that is being gained from neuroscience and how people best learn. First of all, you can't learn if you're not paying attention. When you look at gamers overall, you've gone from 100 million gamers 20 years ago, so pretty much a niche market. Today, there's 2.6 billion gamers around the world. That's the size of the number of people that have smartphones. And importantly, when you look at engagement, the average time spent playing games by that 2.6 billion people is 51 minutes per day. That's more time than spent on Facebook, Instagram, or Snapchat. So the opportunity to really reach an audience to help them learn in an engaging, effective way is huge. There are a number of emerging companies that have quite exciting potential. A couple companies that we've invested in already are Lightner, which is out of Helsinki, Finland, and Dreambox Learning in Seattle. But there's a number of others. Obviously, Minecraft has tremendous potential in the learning market. And one thing, a company that we've written about, and I think has other really important perspective, is Akili, which is Adam Gasly from UCSF, gaming company, which is currently going through FDA approval process. I think that window, really being able to show the efficacy and not only show efficacy, but have the government essentially say this is approved, has profound implications as it relates to what this could mean for the future of learning. I think invisible learning is the perfect description of how people are going to most effectively receive the knowledge they need on an ongoing basis, because you're no longer going to have these kind of episodic interactions with learning. It's going to go on all the time without you even realizing it. The second piece is the kind of multidisciplinary things that are taught. So it's not just a specific thing like learning math, but also increasing other cognitive functions. And one of the major trends going on that we're going to help even make this more immersive is what we're seeing going on with virtual reality. And also just physical activity that you're doing at the same time you're learning. And so these are trends that are going on that really are part of this whole invisible learning, which is just a gigantic opportunity and a critical need in a world where you're going to continue to learn from the time you're born, you know, throughout your life and until you retire, if you ever retire.
Thanks, Michael. Okay, here we go. Episode 77. And let us know what you think via Twitter at Podcast EdTech and at ASU GSV Summit. Have a great week. Yay! So hello and welcome everyone to this panel, and it's great to see so many people join the room. My name is Sophie Bailey and I'm the founder of the EdTech podcast, and for the next 50 minutes we'll be talking about gaming and neuroscience, what has impact and what's a fad. So today's discussion is about measuring impact or efficacy, which is defined as the ability to produce a desired or intended result. There are many different ways to measure impact, including randomized controlled trials, pilot projects, quantitative studies with qualitative follow-up, in-game data tracking, and even the crazy notion that as a teacher, you might be well placed to recognize what has impact with your students. So my first question to today's panelists is, how can we best measure impact? Leanne, I don't know if you want to kick off with Pearson having done so much work around efficacy and measurement as well.
Sure, Sophie. And it's actually a topic that's very fresh in my mind because I just came, actually with probably many of the people in this room, from a first ever EdTech efficacy symposium in Washington, D.C., sponsored by Jefferson Accelerator and UVA and Digital Promise. So a really interesting couple of days to have people in the industry, customers, government agencies, researchers, thinking about what do we really mean by efficacy in education. And I think the takeaway came down to two words: it depends. That there's no one-size-fits-all efficacy measurement for educational products and services. And I think this is actually very germane to this conversation, because I think if you're producing a highly targeted intervention to deal with a particular kind of reading challenge, for instance, I think it's pretty easy there to understand what efficacy means, to understand what sort of research you need to have to validate that that product can deliver an outcome. When you're talking about taking Minecraft and putting it in a classroom, you can see the incredible sort of applications of that technology in the classroom. It's much harder to really quantify what is the impact on learning. And I think we have to get there in this whole arena of game-based learning, of really understanding how play becomes an important aspect of education. I think we have to be able to quantify the outcomes in a measurable way and look at the impact on student learning if all of the things that we're excited about around game-based learning and so forth are really to move forward.
And Frieda, so your service with Climetrics is about better sort of quantifying the students and the applicants and matching those with employers. So I didn't know how you go about measuring impact and success from that point of view as well.
Sure. So we actually work directly with our client customers to look at their recruiting and internal processes. And we really measure three things. One is quality of applicant or employee, measured by how many people are successfully going through the recruiting process and or how many employees that are hired using Pymetrics are retained versus the old process. So that's one. The second thing is diversity. So our platform is gender and ethnic bias free. So therefore, we generally greatly improve the diversity outcomes for companies in terms of recruiting. So we look at gender, ethnic, and socioeconomic diversity in the hiring outcomes. And the third thing is efficiency. How well is the process running in terms of the old process?
Okay, excellent. And we can talk about the neuroscience and
Absolutely.
We'll come to that later on. So my next question really is it actually essential to measure impact? And to kind of put some context behind that, a randomized controlled trial might cost up to $100,000 a year of time and the need to partner with a top university. Most startups or scale-ups in this room possibly can't afford this investment. And a previous market content leader in education said to me that conducting a full-blown efficacy trial was not worth it because teachers didn't believe the positive results that came out anyway. A professor from UCL Knowledge Lab, an expert in efficacy, also discouraged the idea of absolute efficacy being proven, with the idea of measuring apples with apples as unobtainable. So is it actually essential to measure impact, and are there different circumstances and measurements we should be taking into consideration? And Leanne, I know we spoke about perhaps whether there's a different context for EdTech that sells into institutions versus EdTech that perhaps is more direct to consumer.
Yeah, so a couple things in response to that. I think, you know, the problem with doing RCTs, you know, is that by the time you've done these long-term studies, they've been peer-reviewed, they've been published, it's irrelevant. the product is probably either, you know, made it or hasn't made it in the market, and the marketplace has determined whether it's effective or not. So I think one of the themes that came out of last week was, you know, are there other proxies, other ways that we can be more agile and lean about understanding the impact of products? And I the other piece of it, which I think is tied together, is we have to get away from the mentality that the product is either delivering outcomes and is, you know, with efficacy or not. And then there are people who actually use it. And if they get the product and it's efficacious, they will deliver, you know, learning outcomes in the classroom. These things are intertwined. The fidelity of delivery is as important as the product itself. So I would actually advocate, in most cases, a more action research-based approach, where in certain cases you have product vendors and the practitioners actually working together to see what they think the outcome should be, what's the impact they're trying to drive, and then how would you measure it in that particular setting. And you may not be able to make as scientific extrapolations from that, but I think at the end of the day, we'll be more effective at serving students that way. Just coming quickly back to your point about consumer versus classroom. So when we were having this conversation on the sidelines before this, when you talk about education, you're talking about a very, very broad, diverse, highly segmented market, right? Even if you just talk about K-12, you're talking about parents at home from many different parts of the country, from many different parts of the economic strata, who are buying things to improve their kids' learning, right? You're talking about classroom teachers who may be buying supplemental materials. You're talking about buildings, schools that may have school-wide purchases. You're talking about districts purchasing things. You have to talk about schools purchasing things. And the channels for each of those segments is completely different, right? So on one end, you have government business RFP that may take months and months and months to sort of close out. And then on the other end of the spectrum with a parent, you may just be talking about a credit card swipe, right? And I think that the standards for efficacy may be very different across that spectrum. I don't think you're going to expect necessarily the same level of rigor about the efficacy analysis in the card swipe case for a $20 supplemental for your child than you are if you're buying a program that's many millions of dollars for a district for many, many years.
It's very interesting. I mean, Vikas and Michelle, I don't know if you have an opinion on this, but I was just thinking about with your work with schools. So, for example, in the UK, the ICT budget has been slashed by 7% over the last year. There isn't anything in our sort of regulatory body to actually say that teachers need to be measured on their sort of tech savviness. So from the point of view of impact in schools, does that kind of limit the sort of need to perhaps take some of the benefits of what you're doing and apply them within an institution? I didn't know perhaps if you've found that resistance or how you might get around that as well.
Yeah, I can definitely speak to that. With Minecraft, it's a tool that teachers aren't quite as familiar with as their students are. But the great thing that we have going on in a huge diversity, like Leon was saying, across strata of different economic factors, different access to technology, different comfort levels of teachers and educators with technology. The great thing is that we have, in every classroom, we have someone who is professionally and scientifically trained to measure student outcomes, and that's the teacher. And so it doesn't have to be like we're showing some direct outcome that's calculable. Oftentimes, it's more indirect. And I think that when we visit classrooms, the looks on kids' faces, they actually change and morph over the time that we're in there, over the time that the students are engaging with Minecraft or other game-based learning tools as well. And I think it's very natural for teachers to measure engagement in the moment, and engagement is, you know, highly linked to actual memory development and to the learning process and the neuropath that are paved down in the students' neural networks when they do an activity and love doing that activity. And the cool thing there is I was actually just reading the Institute of Play released something that talked about things that are present when students are engaged in game-based learning or game-based play. And one of them is that feedback is constant and relevant. It's immediate, constant and relevant. One of them is that failure is reframed as iteration. Like, that just blew my mind. Like, could we do that? Could we reframe what students today perceive as failure? I got a, you know, a 70% on this or 50% on this. Could we reframe that in the same way that games do, to say, no, try again, you can still make it to the next level. You just have to try again and use what you just learned in that experience to go to the next one. And then so that they're kind of top of the pyramid there is that challenge is constant. And I think challenge being constant in a given learning environment, if you can manage to challenge all the learners in a given learning environment, you've totally won. You're going to teach those kids, they're going to learn.
think from our side, it was interesting to hear what you said, which is, you know, you have the spectrum of people who parents swiping a card all the way to institutions. And I think from what we've seen over the last 2 years since we started, so we build robots that are used in elementary schools for children to learn to code. And when we set out, we had a few things that we wanted to achieve. One was inclusion, which is, can we get girls participating in robotics and coding as much as we see boys? And second, we build a tool that's really effective for the kids at that age. And our starting out focus was on parents. And what we saw very quickly was teachers starting to adopt the product, and probably similar to Minecraft to some extent. And we couldn't figure out initially how that's succeeding because we hadn't really designed the software, everything for the teachers to use it. But we were seeing data, first of all, that the engagement was very high, both at home and in schools. And then, you know, it started out with these parents swiping cards, but slowly going to the points where schools wanted to placing POs directly with us and finding to adopt the product. So we tried to figure out the process from that. And now we've been able to grow from that to more than 10,000 schools using our robots without a single salesperson in our office. And that's largely because focusing on the teachers to find success. So when we measure impact, first from data and our kids engaged with the product. When someone's using it, how often do they use it? Do they come back to it? And do they actually making progress through the challenge? We can see that from the data we collect from the software coming back to us. That's the first metric for us. The second metric we see is word of mouth. When some teacher or someone uses it, is something progressing from that particular teacher in that one classroom to other classrooms? And if that is, then we know that teachers is actually successful. For us, efficacy is important. But even bigger thing for us is, do we see the data that validates what we set out to achieve? So for example, now we host a robotics competition. We had 20,000 kids participate. Of those, 50% were girls. And the winning team was a team of four girls from a rural town in Michigan. And that's something that we haven't ever seen happen before in the robotics competition. Now that's actual data that we see validating what we set out to achieve. And that also leads to the next phase where we now see programs where district-wide deployments and so on, where the questions around efficacy and so on definitely come in, and we're investing a little bit more resources now. But to measure impact, it always comes down to, are we seeing the success that we set out for?
It's quite interesting what you said about gender engagement as well, and balancing that when you think about designing product or service, because when I was preparing for this panel, I spoke to the guys at BAFTA Young Games Designer, and they were even talking about, you know, when it comes down to a game, the choice of how you put together which weapons you might use and what those look like actually correlates to how many sort of female players will engage with it. So it really goes back to, you know, that design element right at the beginning as well.
Yeah, and it's very intentional. So when you design the robot as an example, one of the quick things we found out was to break preconceived notions. So for example, when we designed the robot, if we had the wheels visible, girls often at the young age see this as a car or a truck and they don't want to play with it. We hit the wheels and we found that girls see this more as a character. And that led to eventually what kind of design directions we took to engage both girls and boys.
Amazing. So we're now going to move on to actual resources under discussion and whether they are fads or have impact. So I'm going to play devil's advocate a bit, so brace yourselves on that front. So Michelle, our controversial UK government behaviour czar, Tom Bennett, called Minecraft a fad, saying we need to drain the swamp of gimmicks. He continued, if me saying I think Minecraft is a bit of a gimmick makes you mad, then maybe rethink your attachment to tech. But to be fair to you and to Minecraft, gaming giant Ian Hetherington, who published 90s legendary game Lemmings and continued to work for Sony Games, called Bennett a Luddite in response. So my question to you is Minecraft a fad or does it have real educational impact? And is Tom or Ian correct?
Well, I'm not going to call anybody any names. That's not our thing.
That's a shame. So.
No, not that far of devil's advocacy, I hope. So Minecraft is one of those things that you think about when you compare Minecraft to other brands that really can be approached by anyone. And this goes back to Vikas's incredibly approachably cute robots, by the way. You know, in the same way that, yes, it would be great if I didn't step on Lego in the carpet in the middle of the night because that really hurts. Your kids will engage with Lego from an early age until a very late age. Considering myself a 41-year-old kid still plays with Legos. So there's certain things that you can latch onto and they stay with you for a long time and you can walk away from it and come back. My son actually used to play Minecraft a lot He's in eighth grade now. I've been on the team for about 3 years, so he was in this phase where it wasn't cool now that my mom works on Minecraft, so he actually stopped playing Minecraft for a little bit. It was pretty funny, his little rebellion there. But he played again some more in seventh grade because a group was working on something that was gathering everyone's laptops around the lunch table at school, and they go in and out of it. We're not going to say, like, oh, what, gosh, if somebody stops playing for a month. I mean, it's not like a Candy Crush where they're going to put it down and then maybe forget about it, never go back to it. It's this thing that sticks in your brain. And we've seen people play for a very long time. The interesting thing is that we've seen, this is the coolest thing, we've seen teachers come to us and bring us their lesson plans and bring us their curricula that involves Minecraft and say, hey, this is what I'm doing with your game. Can you make the game work better for what I'm doing with it? And that's really cool. Like we have a group of sixth graders nearby where I work in Seattle. They do a water science lesson for 6 weeks every year in Minecraft because it turns out it's way more interesting for kids to get to manipulate where does the dam go in this ecosystem and how does that affect the salmon spawning patterns. It's way more interesting to do that in Minecraft than to not do it at all, and it's too costly to do it for real because we can't be moving dams around in real life. So there's things you can do in terms of building and modeling and scaling in Minecraft that are incredibly interesting in an educational environment, and that teachers have come to us and said, hey, we really want you to make Minecraft better for our classrooms. So there's just three big things that we've done to try to meet those requests and try to innovate as well. And one of them was to open up the sales of the game in a way that is protective of students' data and security and privacy. So very different than the consumer game. You don't need an Xbox to use it. It's going to go through your Mac or through your Windows PC, and your school signs you up for it and gives permissions and all that kind of stuff so that there is control at the admin level if that's what the district desires. There's also a companion mode we called classroom mode, which allows the teachers, some people have called this God mode, please do not quote me on that. It allows the teachers to take a 2D rendering of the entire game map where maybe 25 students are playing in a game. It allows teachers to go in and drag, say this student is off in the weeds, they're not collaborating with their group, I'm going to drag them back, and that student gets ported back to where where they're supposed to be. The educators can also grant resources and do other things without actually being in the game with the students. And it just makes it a lot more accessible to teachers who want students to lead that sort of learning, especially in like modeling and other applications, but who maybe those teachers are not like going to go home and play Minecraft that night. Maybe that's not their thing. That's totally fine. And then just last week, we actually announced our Code Connection companion app, which allows students to learn to code in Minecraft using various block-based programming languages. Tinker is one of our partners. ScratchX is one of our partners as well. So you can actually attach a coding website or third-party engine to Minecraft and actually program in the game. And it's so incredibly powerful. Like, just go watch a video of this if you have a chance later, because they're just going nuts. And I'm thinking, like, we have tried so many learn-to-code programs with kids, but this one is sticking. Like, we got email this weekend saying, hey, I spent 40 hours on this weekend from, like, a third grader or something like that, saying I want to do this for as long as I possibly can, but now I have to go to school.
So that's quite a good segue into the next question, which is really looking at coding. And we're going to move on to Vikas. So in the UK, we talk about reaching peak beard because people are getting a bit fed up with hipsters. So with all these coding clubs, Hour of Code, devices, and more tracked to the coding curriculum around the world, is coding a fad? Will we look back on it nostalgically? Or is it really imperative for children to be learning lines of code? And just as a backdrop to this, on the plane over, I was editing the episode with Ted Fujimoto, and he was talking about this obsession with coding as when he was at school sort of doing the typing lesson. So I just wondered if, you know, is it a utility or do we really need to learn the mechanics of coding?
So first, broadly for coding, I believe that, yes, I think it's one of the essential skills for kids going into the 21st century. With so much of technology all around us, for any child to make sense of the world, coding is probably one of those essential tools. But now bringing it to kind of some of the stuff that we do, for us, we focus on elementary school for a couple of reasons. One, because that's where we can have the largest possible impact. The kids can possibly be going into middle schools with a lot more interest in science and technology than they would otherwise. And also for us, the focus has been more around joy of learning than about teaching them a specific skill. Because if we can get kids intrinsically interested in exploring with, call it coding, but for us the focus is on kind of problem solving skills without really focusing on the language. So for example, tools are very visual. We build robots and they're very engaging. So it's, you know, it, in some ways it's more about joy of learning than anything else. So we can get kids engaged with that at an early age, then we can have them a lot more curious about the world they're growing up in. And we believe that's very essential for kids. And I don't think it's, in some ways, I wouldn't say coding is particularly new. It's, I think, become a lot more mainstream as a conversation in the last 3 years since code.org launched. I learned to code when I was, I think, 14, and I learned with BASIC. When we first shipped PCs in the 80s, and I remember, this will date me, but we had 5.5-inch floppy disks. You could buy games on them, and once you ran out of games, the only thing you could do was you could program. So you actually learned to program, and I learned with BASIC. And for me, it's been transformative of what I have learned and what it's led me to do in life. And I think that's a lot of people growing up in that age who had access to PCs will probably say the same thing. So I don't think coding per se is either new or a fad. Ever since computers have been created, I think coding has been a very integral part of it. But now what we've seen in the last few years is we have these devices that are in the hands of kids at a very young age. Mm. And then we're asking ourselves, are we setting up the kids for the right kind of success? Because a lot of these devices come with infinite content. They're online, you have access to any as many games as you want to play. Are we still giving these tools to the kids so they can be creators with these tools rather than purely being consumers? And that's, and in a big way, comes from coding as an integral part of them deciphering how these devices work. And that's, I think, is an essential skill. And I don't think it'll be a fad that'll go away in any way. It has, it hasn't gone away for the last, since in the last
with all the devices we have today, everyone doesn't need to like get a computer science degree, but everyone needs to learn to code so they can think computationally and program their dishwasher, right? Like you have, there's so many things. And think of every button you push all day long. Yeah,
and it's not about kids growing up to be computer programmers or computer scientists. To give one example, back, I remember 4 years ago, there was a journalist in LA who was, article was the first one to get online about an earthquake. And that was happened because he had written a program that could detect seismic activity and actually write up the entire article and page him, and he got up within a minute after the earthquake happened, approved the article, and hit a button, and the article got published. Now, he could do it because he knew how to code. And I think that's the world we're moving to more and more, with so much data available to us, so much of it connected, that those elements of coding or working with technology are going to be essential skills. It doesn't matter who you are in the next 20 years, a doctor, an architect, a journalist, whoever you are.
Because, I mean, I know at the moment sort of learning to code is directly correlated with higher earning jobs. I just wondered if, you know, beyond the next 5 years, whether large parts of that will become automated as well. So whether it's about learning the actual coding or learning how to communicate with people who will help action that.
I think it's a combination of two. So another example I'll actually give is, there's a small town in Ohio. There's a total population of 900. Pretty much every single family relies on a job that is probably going to go away in the next 20 years with automation, whether it's trucking or manufacturing. And it happens that, you know, that, and the town recognizes that. And it turns out every single child in the elementary schools is participating in a robotics competition using those robots. So I think whether these kids grow up to be computer scientists or programmers, we don't know, and that's not really an essential thing. But whichever job they grow up to be in, automation and technology is going to be an integral part of their job. So they need to understand it enough so they know how to use it effectively. That's going to be, and doctors is another one, for example. Many of these things where if you're relying on data and knowledge, that's getting automated in a big way and abstracted away from a day-to-day interaction. So what can you do with it is going to become more essential.
Interesting. So what are the panel's thoughts on AR, VR, peer-to-peer and gaming? So that's what we're also talking about today. So just to give sort of my opinion on this one is, I don't think it's so much about, you know, swimming with sharks and VR, but it's more about perhaps where some of these platforms can help solve the student-teacher ratio problems and access to sort of high-risk learning. So things like Labster and having access to an MIT lab and being able to tinker with those things, and if you break them, it's not a problem, and actually having access to those kind of experiences. So I just wondered what your experiences, again, were on that and on things like peer-to-peer. So you've got some chatbot companies, so whether that's EdTech Foundry, you've got AdmitHub, and then I know Pearson are working with IBM Watson. And we talked about peer-to-peer in relation to Minecraft and how kids are working together to kind of build those worlds. So I just wondered where you think these things add value and perhaps where they err towards more the fad side of things.
I'm happy to jump in. I mean, So my current thinking about AR, VR, and we're doing quite a bit of early stage work in this domain. In fact, we're working very closely with Microsoft on two projects, one with Texas Tech around virtual nursing simulations for HoloLens, and then another one with Case Western around virtual anatomy. I had no idea how many cadavers are sold to schools in the United States every year. I think some number like 165,000 cadavers a year, and they're a fortune. And by definition, they don't function. Right, so can you replace that with a fully simulated functioning body, which you can look at as a group, walk around, interact with, go through layers of, get supporting data and evidence around at a lower price point? But I think that's really the thing for me right now is AR, VR is more, it's a value proposition optimization exercise right now. And to your point, actually, what's interesting is where Pearson started in the whole VR space was with a company that was working with oil companies to train oil rig operators out in the Gulf of Mexico or out in somewhere around the world, because the cost of actually simulating that or giving students access to that actual experience was so great that anything you could do that was simulated would be of, even if it, you know, sort of approximated the actual experience and fell short of it by 30%, if you could do it for a hundredth the cost, it was a terrific thing to be able to do. I think trying to find applications for VR and AR, given the current sort of cost structure, you have to look for those applications where you get that real leverage against the cost of doing it any other way. So virtual operations or dissections, working with simulated patients and trying to diagnose their illnesses and things like that. I think over time, as those sort of early adopter parts of the market begin to really churn and we start to see the economics of AR and VR become more acceptable to broader parts of the market, you'll start to see real applications for this. The other thing I would say is I personally haven't been particularly excited by pure VR. I've had a very early Oculus. I've played with VR, even prior generations of it in laboratories. It was when I saw the HoloLens, this is not a Microsoft ad, but when I saw HoloLens that I had sort of an aha moment about the application of this sort of technology in the classroom.
And what was it about that that
I think it's the social aspect of it. The fact that you can have multiple people in the room seeing the same thing and interacting with the same thing just as we are here in this room, it was very much a paradigm shift for me in the experience of interacting with the simulated content. So I thought that was incredibly exciting. You mentioned our partnerships with IBM Watson. I think that whole area is, again, an area where incredible potential. Unfortunately, in this world, the ratio of great teachers to students makes education very hard to scale. Mm-hmm. I went to a private school where there were 15 kids in the class. 1% of the world's population can have that experience, maybe a fraction of 1%, right? If we can get cognitive computing and machine learning to the point, again, where it could be approximate 80% of a highly competent tutor, instructor, teacher in specific settings, that gives us enormous power of scale that we don't have today. And so we're extremely excited about the cognitive tutor project that we're doing with IBM Watson, because that's exactly what we're trying to solve.
And Frieda, on your side of things, so I know that you use gaming and gamification quite a lot on your platform. So could you talk us through, what the thinking is behind that and sort of how it plays out to have impact as well?
Sure. So again, Pymetrics is a platform that uses cognitive neuroscience games and AI to help people find their optimal career fit and then help companies recruit in a more diverse and, fair way. We call it measuring potential over pedigree. So essentially they're using it as a augment or replacement for the CV or the resume, which has a lot of issues. And I think the games that we use, both my co-founder and myself, are PhD level cognitive neuroscientists. We spent a decade at Harvard and MIT, and the games that we use are essentially open source games that have been developed by the cognitive neuroscience community over a series of, two decades, let's say, and they're considered the gold standard of neuroscience. And if you put any of the Pymetrics games in front of a neuroscientist, they would say, oh yes, that's this game and it measures such and such. And I think there are other platforms that also use gamification in career assessment or hiring that also do a good job of tapping into well-established science, different forms of that. I think, you know, in terms of fad versus things that are here to stay, I think there are, you know, other gamified platforms that are a little bit more faddy in the sense that they've either created their own games or they're using games where it's not that clear what it is that they're potentially measuring. And I think there's some, you know, I think, you know, justified skepticism, more skepticism around those platforms because we just don't know, you know, if I created a game in my basement yesterday and I tell you it measures this, you know, there's just not that much scientific validity that goes behind that. So I think there's, you know, they definitely just look into what the science behind the gamified
assessment
is. That
was one of my questions to you, actually. I mean, with your vast experience in neuroscience from Harvard, MIT, and one university from the UK, which I can't remember, Suffolk, was it?
Yeah,
I mean, the people in the audience here, what's the neuroscience they should be paying attention to if you were to call out some particular theories there? And what would you say is more pseudo-neuroscience?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that it's a theory. I mean, unlike psychology, neuroscience is a fairly unified science. It's more in the tradition of biology or chemistry or something where there's not like five different competing theories of neuroscience. It's more like, here's attention, here's memory, here's risk, and here's how we measure it kind of thing. You know, and that's kind of, we think, an advance that cognitive neuroscience provides over, you know, psychology is that it's less sort of tribalistic and it's more, you know, unified. So I don't think there's like one type of neuroscience that is more valid versus another because it's all really the same. I think, again, it's more just that whatever platform is claiming to use neuroscience, I think there should, on the part of the user, be it an individual or, you know, a company, there should just be some due diligence put into understanding what are the claims that are being made and sort of what is the scientific background.
And
that's
so
all.
Perhaps looking into the founder's background and...
Yeah, the founder's background or, you know, most places that are using some form of neuroscience will have, you know, whether it's an advisory board or, you know, some explanation into the science that they're using, and just really poking around. Because again, I think neuroscience is such a hot topic. I mean, when I used to be in the lab, I used to say you can't open like a popular magazine without, you know, the neural network of blah, blah, blah being, you know, on the front page, which is great. But I think it can then, and you know, there's so many, like, people use it in leadership training and people use it for, I mean, all sorts of things, right? And I think that, again, I think it's fantastic that people are interested and I think it's fantastic that applied uses of neuroscience are being developed. I think it's amazing, right? Because of all the billions of dollars we spend on basic research, like, we're actually getting some you know, value out of it. But that having been said, I think the fad makes it such that everyone wants to incorporate, it's just a new buzzword, sort of like AI or gaming or anything. And it's helpful for the consumer, be it individuals or companies, to be a little bit, do their due diligence in terms of platforms.
Okay, so my next question, thinking about AR, VR, and gaming. Recently, internet giant Tencent, obviously based in China, bought Finnish Clash of Clans mobile games maker Supercell for $8.6 billion. So just to think about the kind of sums of money involved here. Vikas, this is a question for you. So do we need to be careful that we don't chase AR, VR, and gaming because that's where the money is? So perhaps lots of people in this room, investors and so on, as opposed to where the impact might lie for educators and sort of teachers and students in the classroom?
So on VR side, I think I'm very close to where Luyan is. Like, I've been fairly skeptical of VR per se. And you know how it has an impact on gaming and what we pursue there, but I think there is some potential. I think on the what kind of content can be created on the education side. To give a couple of examples, one, I've seen some uses of VR very early on around therapy for stuff like autism or other areas, which you can create an environment which is very hard, if not impossible, to create for those children without a framework like VR. So that's interesting. I don't know what the progression from there will be, but the early signs that I see that seems very promising for that space. And the other one that I've been interested in, I haven't seen the kind of content being created here, is VR is one of the places where you can bend the laws of physics. So for example, there's no reason why light has to be have the same speed in VR in that one environment that it has in real life. And the moment you shift that, because I remember reading a story way back when I was growing up, If your speed of light was similar to, let's say, the speed of, you know, at 60 miles an hour, your world will look very differently, right? People will age differently, everything will just be very different. And that's the first moment. Suddenly the theory of relativity just lives in front of you just like gravity does. And that's a great way for kids to experience those aspects, which you can't do in any other way. Videos can't do that, and real life can't do that. And I think if we can go there, we can actually have a pretty impactful aspect of education.
It's quite an interesting one because there's a whole movement, I think, around that, isn't there, around alternative reality and you know, whether that can even like lift people out of depression by thinking, you know, outside of the world that we currently live in, perhaps.
So from my experience with AR/VR is fairly personal, actually. By coincidence, my husband works on HoloLens, so thank you for the compliment. I'll pass those along to the team. We got to have some of these cool devices at our house before most people had seen them, and that was really neat. And my parents were visiting. My dad was 72 last summer and had never left North America. Okay, so I mean, he grew up as a mechanic and owned gas stations in Detroit, so it wasn't a thing you did. And so he puts on this headset, and we show him this square in Rome. I don't know why this was what was on the headset at that time, but he's looking at it, and he was like, this is amazing. He's like, can I go anywhere in this thing? And I'm like, yes, you can. And he's like, no, like, let's go. And so we went to Rome. We went and took my parents to Europe, and they'd never been before. And my dad's walking around the whole time going like, this is almost as cool as in the headset, but it smells different. You know, like, he was like, it opened his mind up to like this, I can do anything, I can go anywhere, I'm gonna sit on a plane and go there. And so when we're like, I also worked with Code.org this past fall, and we developed an hour of code together with them, and I'm in a school in New York, and there's this group of kids who comes after school to play Minecraft, and so we kind of tried to test our hour of code experience with Minecraft with this group of kids. The teacher was like, hey, if you have anything, let's test it together with these kiddos. They're awesome kids. And so I came in, and there's one girl, and she's just like this. She's sitting in the back, she's looking at her lap, not looking at the computer at all. Her computer's in front of her. I was like, hey, what's going on? She's like, I don't know how to code. I don't code. I can't code. And I'm like, okay, well, do you play Minecraft? And she's like, well, yeah, I love Minecraft. And she was very adamant. And I was like, okay, show me how you play. And so I just watched her play for a couple minutes. And I was like, oh, well, what would happen if you did this? And she's like, oh, I could do that? And I was like, yeah, that's coding. You're coding. And she's like, I am? And it was like, it just opened her mind to it. And so, like, I mean, that's not AR/VR, but like, just this idea that we can open people's minds to things through AR/VR or through coding and give them these little gateways of things they're already familiar with to get them to places that they might be a little uncomfortable trying out or going, and then push people to learn and experience and grow in those ways. Like, that's totally why I do my job. It's so exciting and powerful to watch.
I mean, that's a great segue into this idea of invisible learning. So thinking about that, I mean, you've got companies like Lightner, who I know are here from Finland, and they're creating mobile games to help teach particle physics. So each of the characters is one of the periodic table, and they kind of go on little adventures together.
That's awesome.
And blow up things and stuff like that. The other one is a UK gaming company called Wibu, and they've created a game which helps teach language learning, so Spanish and Portuguese and English, taking place through an adventure game. So I just wanted to explore what your thoughts were around this idea of invisible learning, and also if there's kind of any neuroscience behind what someone might experience in a formal setting versus an informal setting. So for example, with Wibu, the CEO, what he talked about was the language acquisition theorist, Stephen Krashen, and his idea that once you put someone in a setting where they're embarrassed or they feel under threat, then that ability to take on knowledge is massively closed down. And I'm sure that must apply across, you know, outside of language. So just wanted to explore your thoughts on that, and then we'll move on to takeaways, and that should take us to time as well today.
Well, I think that I'm not a huge fan of the term invisible learning, in that I think it presupposes that learning somehow is something it's the vegetable that you're trying to hide, you know.
Chocolate covered broccoli.
And I think I look at it the other way around. How do you make the learning the thing that people really want to do? And where I've seen that work best, and where I think game-based learning actually can be an incredible sort of impetus for that. So just give an example. This is going back to 1989, 90, we created at Dalton School in New York City, a simulated archaeological excavation. Originally not even, this was pre-computer, it was in a sand pit in the backyard of the school. And we buried fake artifacts from a Greek ruin there. And we just let the third graders have at it, you know, figure out what was going on, organize as teams, figure out how they were going to excavate different parts of the site. Guess what? They were starting to use Cartesian graphing to try to figure out, you know, where should they dig after they dug in a particular place to see the relationship between items. The artifacts had Greek text on it. So they were running over to the high school and corralling the Greek teacher, the classics teacher, to help them decipher these words. We happened to be near the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They were taking these artifacts to the museum to go try and see if they could find real versions of those to find out what they actually were. And so I like to say that that game, that simulation, had a centripetal learning effect. It sent the kids out into more formal learning environments with an energy and a motivation that they don't have without that game experience. It created the context for their learning. You know, it created it was a learning quest. It gave them the compelling questions that made the more formal forms of the learning interesting and exciting to them. So that's the relationship that I see that game-based learning has with more formal forms of learning. And I think they go hand in glove together when you do it just right.
I mean, I think the only one thing I can, or a couple of things I can add is, I think when you focus on the younger kids, for us, one of the things we want to do is for them to have an intrinsic motivation to do the things they do. And one of the things that, especially when it comes to coding, is not have girls or boys feel the coding is not for them. And I think you start out at a point where it is all games and fun, but the goal is to lead them to a point where there is a deep end of the ocean. And if you have, and especially things like, you know, with Carol Dweck's, you know, theory around intrinsic motivation, and if you have kids intrinsically interested, then there's a natural pursuit that they can take on from there. And one of the things we also look at, having kids articulate back what they've learned along the way, because then you can try to bridge this gap from kind of game-based learning or what I call invisible learning, but to a more interesting, I'm actually learning something that I can articulate to someone else, and I'm proud of it, and then I'm interested to take it further. I think that's what we look to achieve in everything we do.
I would add one other thing, which is that, you know, the formal-based learning, I think, unfortunately, at least in this day and age, really can be somewhat, it can be exclusive to certain populations. I mean, my daughter has dyslexia, you know, which affects between 10 and 15% of the population. There's obviously a high number of children that have, you know, ADHD. So anyone that has a learning disability can feel quite, you know, at a disadvantage, I think, with sort of more formal types of learning. And it's not an insignificant number of the population. And that leads to all sorts of, you know, not optimal outcomes unless it's remediated. And then the remediation is obviously very intensive. So I think that if we can use more, whether it's gaming that aids with invisible learning or whatever, you know, nomenclature you want to put to it, to actually incentivize or, you know, like basically get kids excited about learning rather than what we consider sort of more formal learning. I think it's just shifting in terms of what we consider formal versus informal. And I think it's going to change over time. And I think the whole idea is to get kids to, in quotes, learn. And does it have to be through reading and writing, or can it be through, you know, completely different types of activities that are more inclusive to the population at large, you know?
The inclusivity and the opportunity to become digital leaders in a way that some of these students are not able, like capable even, of becoming, you know, leaders in the sense that, you know, they're not gonna be the loudest kid in the room. In fact, we've been in classrooms where there's like an introvert, the kid who sits in the back, but he actually knows more about how to, you know, build a successful farm in Minecraft than anyone else. And so, you know, one of the classrooms that we were in, there was a kid who would just keep answering questions. And this was a long time ago, before we had our connection to the school network for identification. But like, there was just a kid, they didn't even know who he was. Everyone in the class was asking, who is this kid? He knows all the answers to everything. Who is this kid? He was on the chat constantly, and all the other students were using this kid as a resource. They didn't even know who he was. And then when it came to light who he was, he's like the shy kid in the back corner. He actually started crying. Aww. It was incredibly powerful to watch, because they all went over and like thanked him. They're like, you taught me this today, and like, you helped me find my friend on the map. And like, and he actually started crying. It was this amazing moment where like, he didn't have that opportunity because he was an incredible introvert, and the teacher said he struggled with a couple different learning challenges, and it was super fun to watch.
Sorry, I just had one more thing. So, and I mean, dyslexia really, they had this, you know, mentor of mine who once said, would we even have dyslexia if we didn't need to read, right? Because we haven't needed to read other than for the last, you know, 1,000 years essentially, right? Like sort of the invention of the printing press. And prior to that, it was like the oral tradition, right? So in a way, if you think about the history of mankind, like dyslexia is like, it's a sort of created disorder that we have, that if we didn't actually need to read, maybe there would be no such thing as a dyslexic brain. So just thinking about how we're constantly evolving. And
when Einstein was dyslexic,
right.
And so on.
I need to hook you guys up with the learning tools in OneNote that help with this.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, in fact, one episode of the EdTech podcast was with Microsoft and the British Dyslexia Association and covered off a lot of this. But I'm going to push for one extra minute just to give our takeaways, because I know we're at time now. So my own takeaways for everyone in the audience is check out Professor Roland Fry's Ed Labs at Harvard. So he's looked at alternative faster models for measuring efficacy and impact, so more in tune with this idea of iterative design and sort of in line with the tech community perhaps. Check out UCL's research accelerator Educate, who are trying to support impact trials for startups. And I know that here Jefferson Education Accelerator and partners are doing similar. Go and check out the London Educational Games community. So at Twitter, they are at LegUp. They were my go-to when I was thinking about preparing for this panel. There's numerous initiatives in this space, so HTC VR for Impact, Games for Social Good, the Learning Games Network, playfullearning.com, and so on and so on. And I know there must be more out there. And then also thinking about collaboration outside of the edu gaming industry to other sectors. So how can we bridge the gap between games designers and neuroscientists or pedagogical academics? So you talked about getting those kids to go to the museums, to the formal learning spaces. In the UK, there's the Wellcome Trust, and they actually fund games which help support science and arts. So they put developers in contact with experts in pharma, Alzheimer's, and biomedical, and I'm sure there's other games around dyslexia, etc. So we've probably got 30 seconds max. I don't know if anyone wants to throw anything else in.
I would throw out The Game Believes in You by Greg Tappo. It's a book that Greg writes for USA Today. It's a book that talks about how like the early psychology and motivation behind video games and what would make you want to put that another quarter into the video game was knowing that like you didn't quite get it last time, but you know you can get it next time, and the game actually believes you can get that done. It talks about how if we can bring some of that, like, you know, that sort of faith in learning into the classroom, how amazing that is.
On Twitter, I'm just at Lu Yan Cho. I just posted all the links to the Jefferson efficacy stuff from last week there if you're interested in the topic of efficacy as well.
I think talking about whether coding's ever been a fad or not, I think if you haven't seen the work from Seymour Papert at MIT, I think it's huge body of work, books like Mindstorms and others, which has influenced so many people and researchers on the works being done here. It's a fascinating body of work.
Okay, I'd like to give the panelists a massive round of applause, please, everyone. And thank you very much for coming. Well, that brings us to the end of this first episode from the 10-part ASU GSV Summit series, which will cover everything from gaming to AI to China and Australia to design thinking and alternative higher education funding. I do hope you enjoyed. Send us your feedback on Twitter to either at @podcastedtech or at @ASU GSV Summit, and come back next time for our next episode on 21st century skills.